Hello, everybody. This is Josh Beiser from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. We got a great cast for you tonight. Our topic and guest is going to be another indie developer who is currently working on his latest title. It is the RPG exploration game Venture Forth, which at the time of this recording is currently on early access. And he's here tonight to talk more about the game as well as being a developer on the early access platform. So please welcome from Arc Light Worlds, Jeremiah Ingham.
Hey, how's it going?
It's great to have you on, Jeremiah. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
It's great to have you on. For those of you who've been listening to previous casts, Jeremiah and Chris from probably last week, in terms of when these recordings go up, are all under the same indie label, Indie Voyage, who I spoke with their co-founder, Robert Leach, on an earlier cast.
Yep.
So I guess to start with then, Jeremiah, for people listening to this cast, and since it's your first time on, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your background in terms of game development?
Well, my name's Jeremiah Ingham, and I guess the way that I originally got into game development was actually from the technical side. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, growing up, I was always a big video game fan. Basically, I grew up on the NES, and so Zelda and Metroid and all those kinds of open-world exploration games were, like, really what I loved. But I had never really considered actually creating games until I got to college and I actually learned how to program. So I went to UCLA, and I had basically a life-changing course in programming, and so I learned how to program in C++. And so naturally, after learning how to do that, the first thing I'm like is, all right, let's make a game. And so I started making all these like little text-based games, and it just slowly evolved from there. And so then I learned like DirectX and OpenGL and 3D graphics and all that stuff. So I kind of entered game development from that technical programming side. And so that was about 6 years ago now.
And with Ventured Forth, is this like your first like full like game you are making and selling, or have you released other games in the past?
This is the first full to market game. Yeah.
It's always interesting speaking to developers, especially when it's their first like full game, because obviously as a programmer, you know that many times developers will work on little projects to either test their skills or see they can do something. And then when it's time to go full, you know, the whole process, design, program, sell, and market, it's just like a completely different experience and feel. I guess for you, like, how are you finding it, this being like your first actual game project?
Well, like you said, being an indie developer, you have so many different job roles. And so, you know, like I said, I originally entered this from the technical side of programming and that sort of thing. And so when it comes to programming and the actual like development of the game engine and everything like that, like I am very comfortable in what I'm working with. But since starting, I've had to take on so many other roles, like marketing and publishing and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's where Indie Voyage comes in, and they've been really helpful, and Rob's great. But yeah, creating a game, there's so many different aspects to it. It's so much more than just programming. And so, I mean, I've had to figure out how to do the art and the sound, and so I found some really talented people to help me do that. But even with them helping me, I need to be able to like direct that and figure out how all of that gets imported into the game. And so it's definitely having this be the first all-inclusive project, there's definitely been a lot of learning. Mm-hmm. It is a big project, but yeah. It's I like it.
Mm-hmm. I was checking out the Steam page for it just before we started recording. You've been working on the game previously before Early Access for like a few years now?
Yeah, so it's been I've been working on it for about 3 years now. Mm-hmm. So in the universe of PC games, it's actually kind of interesting. It seems regardless of the team size, most PC games do take about 3 years to make. Mm-hmm. So that's across the board from indie games all the way to AAA games that have like hundreds of people working on them. Mm-hmm. 3 years is a very common development cycle for PC games.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that it's very interesting to talk about because there really aren't a lot of hard discussions or knowledgeable topics when it comes to the ins and outs of actually making a game. It's one of the reasons why I really enjoy doing the stuff here on Game Wisdom is being able to talk about this stuff. Because again, mm-hmm. to the general consumer, they have like no idea really, and there's really like no easily access or credible source of information to talk about what exactly goes into taking this idea and making a video game out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting how many people think, oh, you make games, so you basically just play games all day, right? It's like, no.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think a lot of it is the fact that creating games really is an art, and there's no like set formula for, okay, you need to go through this checklist and do these things, and then you're going to release, and you're going to have a successful game. Like, so much of it is just unknown, and there's like a sort of there's like a little bit of magic that happens mm-hmm. in each successful game, and it's mm-hmm. really difficult to capture that.
Yes, and that could easily be a 2-hour discussion we could have mm-hmm. right here. And I know we've come close to having those with multiple guests in the past. And you are definitely right there, Jeremiah, about mm-hmm. there is video games are very much an art and a product at the same time. And mm-hmm. when you try to combine the two, it becomes infinitely more complex and challenging to do. And we've seen so many games struggle with balancing these two sides. They either make mm-hmm. something that's so artistic and unique that it just is unmarketable, or something that has been done, you know, 800 times before then, and and everyone is just sick to death of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy that you bring up because, like, one of the things that I've learned creating this game is, like, in the things that you design, it's mm-hmm. it's important to have originality, but you also need to have a good balance of familiarity. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't do too many things different. People playing the game still need to feel like they know what's going on mm-hmm. and they're at home. And then on top of that familiarity, you start putting your own unique parts in.
Your spin, essentially.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very much a tricky aspect because over the mm-hmm. last decade, we've really seen game design standardize in a mm-hmm. lot of ways, thanks to the standard form of gamepads these days, games mm-hmm. being ported to multiple platforms. And you're right about that, Jeremiah, that people, when they go into a game, they don't want to go into it completely at square zero. They don't want to start mm-hmm. with, like, no knowledge because mm-hmm. those games are obviously a lot harder to learn. It's why we've seen a lot of games use standard either UI design, standard mm-hmm. control methods, just mm-hmm. something to say, oh, you've played so-and-so. Well, you can at least use a little bit of that trying to learn this game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting because if you look at the games back in the day, like in the 80s and mm-hmm. on the NES, that sort of thing, games used to be a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of that has to do with the design. Mm-hmm. Like games today are designed in a way that's much more intuitive for you to understand. And also, mm-hmm. obviously, there's the whole culture that's already built up. And so when you're designing a game, you have a lot to go off of in terms of player knowledge going into it, so it's a lot easier for them to pick up.
Yeah.
So with this evolution of design and experience, games have gotten a lot easier and I think more fun.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think a good example of that would be like the rise of like the Demon's Souls series. A game like that, with its complexity and challenge, you would think that was not that would not become a massive success. And yet, not only did it become a success, it basically, you know, gave the okay to see this huge surge of roguelikes and games aimed more at the harder end of the scale. Stuff like Super Meat Boy, roguelikes like Dungeons of Dreadmore, FTL, and so on.
Yeah, that's a good point. Dark Souls is definitely, like, one of my favorite games, and I've definitely taken a little bit of inspiration from that in designing Venture Forth.
Yep, and there's, again, always that challenge, as we were talking about a few seconds ago, regarding that balance of unfamiliarity with what is standard. And we see this especially in the indie space, because one of the defining qualities that we've seen from the market is just how unique and original these games are. I mean, over this last year, I've played everything from RimWorld to the finish of Prison Architect to so many. I've probably forgotten more indie games that I've played this year. It's insane. And each one of those games is just a completely original thing that, we've said this time and time again, but these are games that would literally not be made anywhere else without these indie developers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. The indie development world is definitely a really interesting place to find very unique ideas, things that you don't find explored other way, other places.
And it's become a very interesting market as well to examine. I mean, we can, there are just so many topics we could easily bring up to fill an hour or two on this cast. And I guess for you then, I guess my question, as you've been working on this game for a few years now, from your own experience with developing Venture Forth, how are you finding the indie game market, or what's it like being inside it right now?
Well, I guess the main word that comes to mind is uncertain. It's an uncertain market. It seems like it's really difficult to create a game that you know is going to be successful.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a good number of indie developer friends, and a lot of them are really, really talented people. And, you know, I've been with them as they develop their game, and, like, they develop really amazing games. And then it comes time to release, and it's like some of them are successful and some of them are really not successful at all. Yeah. And it seems like a lot of it is just has to do with luck and timing and where the market is. Because, I mean, it's not like these are bad games. And, you know, the ones that are successful, they're good. But kind of like what I was saying before, how game design is an art, it's really difficult to say what's going to make, what is it that's going to make your game successful. And a lot of that just has to do with timing and luck.
Yeah, definitely with that one. I mean, over the last 4 years of doing these casts with developers and basically getting a firsthand look at the independent market and space, there are just so many different game designs out there. And again, you never know if a game like Her Story would be a massive hit, or even something like Stardew Valley, which seemingly just like came out of nowhere one day and just like erupted the charts, same as Undertale. Now, even though some of these games, they were kickstarted successes, like The Darkest Dungeon and even games like Moon Hunters from Kitbox Games. But even with the success of Kickstarter, you still never know what your game is going to do until you slap the big 1.0 on it and say, okay, it's done, come and play it.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, I think that one thing Kickstarter does is it kind of gives you a way to test the market, to see if at least the what you're marketing at the time of Kickstarter, which common definitely between the time of Kickstarter and release, the product does change quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But at least where it is during the Kickstarter, it gives you a way to test and see, like, hey, is this something that people are interested in right now?
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes, if you do have a successful Kickstarter, it is a really good indication of how successful you will be at launch.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not successful, then you got a little bit of work to do.
Yeah. And we've seen cases like that as well. And even with Kickstarter itself, there have been unfortunate cases where a game that does manage to get the funding it needs still doesn't. They either A, don't make it out of the gate to get to release, or they release a game and it just, you know, does horribly for them, such as with like Planetary Annihilation and what happened with them. And I think, it goes back to what we were saying, that there is definitely an art to making good video games, and there is no way we will be talking about that in 1 hour. It's just so big of a topic, and I mean, over the last 4 years, we've been exploring that here on Game Wisdom with my posts, my new video series, and talking to guests like yourself, but... There's still, as you said, Jeremiah, there's no manual for this. There's no checklist you're going to finish and, you know, voila, you have a 10 out of 10 game of the year game. It's never going to happen like that.
Yeah, it's a tough business to be in, for sure.
Yep, and it's one of those businesses, as we said, that you just never know sometimes how the market is going to swing. I was talking with... Charles from Jira Technology, or Jira Technology, I'm going to say, a few weeks ago about his game, Concealed Intent. And he was saying how when he first conceived the idea like 4 years ago, there were no – the space genre, the space game genre was pretty much non-existent at that time. And he thought he was going to be, you know, like, ha, the only guy making it, you know, like the first one. And then by the time I told him to get the game out, the genre has just – exploded. We've seen so many games of that caliber. And again, as you were saying a few minutes ago, it can take, to make a good game, it can take a few years to make that.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. From the time where you conceive a game and start work and actually decide to work on it to the time of release, like a couple years pass, and so much can happen to the market in that amount of time. And it's, I mean, that's definitely one of the really big reasons why it's so difficult working in developing games, is because the market is so difficult to tell where it's going to go. And it takes a lot of investment into one game. I mean, working for multiple years on one project is a huge investment.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean... I've spoken to developers in the past who have worked on these massive games, and it is a giant risk when you have all your time, money, and energy tied up in a 3-4 year project, and you have no idea that's going to even make bank by the time you're done with it. It is a very scary thing, and as you said, Jeremiah, it's very risky. It's one of the reasons why we've seen, I think, unique games, or the ones that, again, balance uniqueness with still that level of refinement, have done really well, because they can sort of stand outside of the market in a manner of speaking. Something like Don't Starve or The Binding of Isaac. Like, these games that there really aren't anything like it, so they don't need to essentially worry too much, but the market still can have an impact on these games.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the market has an impact on everything. Following the success of really big indie games is definitely a very interesting journey, shall we say.
And it also goes back to what we're saying, that the consumer really doesn't have a lot of information about what goes into a game. And we've seen this with like any other like entertainment medium. When there is one success, other people will either attempt to copy it, or will try and break it down and find that, you know, quote unquote, the secret sauce of what made it work.
Yeah, I mean, how many Minecraft clones have we seen?
Yes, and for anyone listening, we could substitute Flappy Bird, Angry Bird. We can even go 20 years ago, Super Mario, and so on.
Yeah.
And it's definitely that very tricky to balance that, because AAA developers and the market really likes when they have these genres or designs that they know work, because it's less risk for them. Again, we can point to almost any period of the game industry, and there's most likely going to be a popular genre or a preferred genre for that time span.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting thing you bring up about AAA. The way that I kind of look at it is indie developers are kind of like the researchers on the forefront of game design, and when they find something that's really good, AAA developers will commonly take that and try and refine it and polish it as much as possible.
Yeah.
And so they take the ideas that indie developers have come up with that turn out to be successful, and then try and do them as well as they can. And and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Yeah. Throwing 100 people at a game doesn't always result in something good.
Yeah, definitely. And the developers who do manage to do this right have become some of like the top tier makers of the industry. I did a critical thought. By the time you're listening to this cast, it'll be a few weeks already. But for when we're talking right now, it's a few days ago, talking about Blizzard. And Blizzard is definitely one of the masters at refining design.
Yeah.
They rarely make a purely 100% original game, but what they do is so well is they make a game that's so refined that it sort of becomes a part of their own brand. And in that sense, it becomes original in some kind of strange transmogrification almost.
Yeah, Blizzard is definitely a very interesting company. I'm not exactly sure on their process for their very early games, like StarCraft 1 and Diablo 1, but certainly in the later years, I think one thing that they do is they take a lot longer to develop a game than other studios. And so, I mean, like, you look at how long it took for StarCraft 2 to come out, how long it took for Diablo 3 to come out.
Yeah.
I mean, those were, like, what, almost decades? And so I think what they're doing there is they create something, but then they go through a lot of iterations of giving it to people, letting them play test it, changing it, refining it over and over. So when it comes time for actual release, like, they have a pretty darn good idea that it's going to be successful because they've tried it on the market so many times.
Yeah. And it's just insane that they figure out that way to, again, take something that another developer has done or another genre and say, okay, here's what this is, here's what works, here's what doesn't, let's make it better. And pretty much like 9 times out of 10 with Blizzard, they're going to make it better. I mean, for the life of me, I cannot think of any one of their games that has gotten like a uniformly bad review. They've always, they're probably one of like the highest rated developers in the world.
They're very consistent.
Yeah. And again, every one of these topics we're talking about is easily like 2 hours of discussion. I mean, it is insane just like how much we can really get into detail about them. Now, again, like, if we do that, we'll be here until probably like midnight next week. So we better talk.
We better
get back and try to stay on topic, at least somewhat. It's always difficult for those of you listening to this cast, you know what that's about. But so for you, Jeremiah, with Venture Forth, my mistake, for people listening to this cast, what is the game about?
Well, Venture Forth, it's open world. First person volcanic caves. It's all magically twisted and open for you to explore to your heart's content. And there's also some really cool real-time combat with swords and bows and magical items. And so it's a roguelite, so not quite a roguelike. So basically you enter this world, and it's your job to go through and explore in any direction you want encountering all sorts of creatures and arming yourself with what you need to explore the darkest depths of the cave.
Okay. And as we said, you've been working on this game for a few years now. Where did the original concept for Venture Forth come from?
It's actually kind of an interesting story. So my brother actually recently, except not recently, it's been a few years now, but he actually moved to Australia. And so we had the opportunity to go visit him in Australia. And so while we were there, we toured around, and one of the places that we went to was this cave called Janolan Caves, which is a little bit east of Sydney. And it's one of the biggest cave systems in the world. And so while we were touring this, like, walking through this giant cavern and hearing people talk about it and how, like, as we were touring through it, they tell us how the original explorers who found this were going through, and they, you know, as they go into these really deep, dark tunnels, and you don't know how far it goes or what you're going to find. I mean, some people, you know, we were in one cavern where it was like, before we drilled this tunnel into the mountain, it was like a 12-hour hike down into these depths in order to reach this place. And so basically touring those incredible caves is what inspired me to start creating this game. Like that night, even though I was in Australia on my like tiny little netbook laptop, I like started creating this game. I'm like, oh man, I gotta do it.
And it's always interesting how we hear developers have such different sources of inspiration. Hearing you talk about it, Jeremiah, reminds me of when I spoke to Crow Team when they were coming up with the Talos Principle, and how they are huge fans of architecture from around the world, and how it inspires them with their designs and what they want essentially the games to look like.
Yeah, architecture can definitely be really interesting.
And with a game like that, with like the kind of like maze-like system, I guess for people listening, in terms of Venture Forth, is the world like randomly generated, procedurally generated, or is it set each time?
So parts of it are procedurally generated. I will be making it fully procedurally generated, but not for the original release. Basically, right now, what I'm going to do for the original release is there will be a few different versions of the world that I'll create. So probably 5 different versions of the world. And when you start a new game, you can either just have it randomly pick one or pick one yourself if you want to play the same world as like your friends. And basically what that consists of is, there's what I kind of call these like mini levels, which I call landmark areas. So there's a bunch of landmark areas in the game. And when you create a world, the worlds that I will create, I manually select some of those landmark areas and then put them into the world and then connect them. But when I add the fully procedural part, it'll be kind of a combination of procedural generation and these landmark areas. So it'll be like these little mini levels, and then the game will select a subset of those mini levels, put them into the game, and then procedurally connect them.
All right. I guess my next question then for you, in terms of designing the levels essentially by hand for right now, what was like your overall like philosophy, or how did you want to build these levels out for the player?
Kind of the main thing that I'm looking for in this game, in terms of the exploration, is when you go into one of these little areas for the first time, there might be only a couple different ways that you can go. But ideally, in each one of these little mini levels, there will be different places that you can get to depending on the different abilities that you've acquired. So you might go through an area and, you know, take one route off to the right, and then you get this item that like a hookshot that allows you to get to much higher ledges, and then you come back to that area and you're like, oh, I can get to that cliff over there that has that like floating flaming sword on it, and then you can go over there and get that, and then, you know, you get this other item that allows you to like see through fake walls, and then you go back and you're like, oh, there's this other passage over here. So a lot of it has to do with the idea of the first time you enter an area, it feels way different than when you enter it at the end of the game, because after you gain all these abilities, then you have all the option to go so many more places. And so it's like it looks completely different now, because you have all these options.
Yeah. And we see that a lot, especially of the Metroidvania genre.
Exactly.
Like how the level designs can... The level designs don't change, but how you go through them will radically be different.
How you
from...
perceive them, yes.
And
yeah, I would definitely say that this game falls into the Metroidvania genre.
And that's always very tricky to balance in terms of what tools are you essentially going to give the player. And we've had discussions of Metroidvania design in the past. I guess for you, Jeremiah, and Venture Forth, like... You just mentioned, of course, like X-ray, being able to see through walls and such. What are some, like, do you have any other examples of either items or even new mechanics that the player will essentially have to influence how they go through the game?
Well, there's a few different, like, in the Metroidvania genre, I think kind of what you call it is gated exploration. So you have all of these areas, and there's certain gates that you have to get by. And, you know, sometimes they're actual physical gates with a lock and key, but a lot of times they're just things that you can't get through because you don't have the ability to. And so in Venture Forth, some of the gates are like really wide open chasms, really deep. So getting across a chasm, getting down a cliff, getting up a cliff. There's also really deep lakes and rivers and like really deep tunnels that have that are full of water, and there's also lava tunnels to get through, and there's like these illusory walls that you eventually get that item that allows you to see through and open up new passageways. So yeah, and then there's various different abilities that you can get that gets you past those gates. So yeah, those are kind of what some of the gates are in this game.
All right. And it's always tricky when you're trying to balance that as a designer, as you want to make it involve, but at the same time, for every new mechanic you introduce, it just changes everything else of how you play the game. It's why, like, commonly we see in lesser quality Metroidvania is that it's simply just, like, again, like a key to a locked door. And then we have games where, as you were saying, Jeremiah, like, the gate could be you need the triple jump ability or the power to glide down or, you know, all kinds of even, like, greater insanity stuff we've seen in other titles.
Yeah. Yeah, so when it comes to the gated exploration in this game, I try to have a lot of gates be mechanic-based. So your character gains the ability to do something rather than just, oh, you found a key. It fits in the red door.
Now, another part of Venture Forth, as we said earlier, is the combat system and the items as well. Could you talk a little bit more about how you're seeing combat play out in the game?
So, the combat is, it's not a necessary part of the game. So, like, one of the legitimate ways to play the game is to just kind of be stealthy and run around enemies and avoid combat if that's the approach that you want to take. So basically you'll equip some items that make you a lot faster, that sort of thing, so you can get away from enemies. So that's like one approach that you can have to the combat is just avoid it. But then there's also like melee combat with swords and there are various swords that have special abilities, and then there's also range combat, so you have bows. It's kind of interesting. In a lot of the levels, I have, like, these little wisp creatures that float around and don't do anything, and as I watch a lot of people play the game, it's kind of funny how many of them will just like sit in a room and just shoot wisps all over. I'm like, they don't do anything. They just like doing it. So people really like using the bow. So basically how the bow is implemented, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, so basically you have the option of avoiding combat, being like your juggernaut melee guy, or being an agile archer, that sort of thing. And then there's also various magical equipment that has special abilities to like manipulate time and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds very interesting in terms of that combat system. I love the example of players just shooting like wisps in the air. And it's one of those common things we see with any game. If there is something in there, the player will try and figure out what its purpose is. Like, and you can really just like troll people that way. You know, they always think there is a purpose to something. Like, you know, if you do this, it'll open up a secret door. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's just there to exist.
Yeah.
Now, I guess, as you said a few minutes ago, in terms of the landscape itself, right, for what's going to be considered 1.0 when you release the game, mm-hmm. will be these linear maps, but you'll have those landmark sections.
Well, I wouldn't call them linear. They're not okay. Linear, but they're not procedurally generated. Well, okay. The world isn't fully procedurally generated. Okay. There's still going to be tunnels that are procedurally generated, and the items and enemies that spawn are going to be procedurally okay. generated. What will be set is which landmarks you're going to encounter and where they are.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, gotcha.
So, I mean, right from the inception of this game, I have been planning on having it be procedurally generated. So the mm-hmm. whole game is designed for that procedural generation. So there is still going to be a good bit of that. Mm-hmm. But the set worlds that you start with at 1.0, when you start a new game, things will look familiar, even mm-hmm. though there will be procedural generation on top of it.
Okay, gotcha. And I guess that takes me to this question, and for you, Jeremiah. In terms of balancing this game around the procedurally generated designs and situations, mm-hmm. we see this a lot as a challenge for designers in terms of figuring out, how am I going to program the game to give the player a challenge without either A, overwhelming them, or mm-hmm. B, just it's, you know, like the same thing, but maybe instead of a blue corridor, it's a red corridor and stuff like that.
So are you talking about procedurally generating and making the world, like the actual physical layout of the world, interesting? Or are you talking about balancing difficulty in the creatures that you encounter?
I think my question probably is a little bit of both. So okay. in terms of making sure that when someone loads up Venture 4th for each time they play, mm-hmm. that they're still experiencing new and different things, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it's not like like there's a 1 in 5 chance the game will spawn a level that is just going to kill me in 5 seconds kind of a deal.
Well, so I'll address each of those separately. So in terms of difficulty, I definitely think that that's something that I still need to refine a little bit mm-hmm. on the way the build is right now. But basically what it is when the game is created, we will know what kind of, in general, what sequence of areas will be able to be reached. So, there's no one way to go, but basically we will know that from the beginning, there will only be a few of the areas available. And so those mm-hmm. will have lower, easier creatures in them. And then from those, we know the various abilities that you're able to collect from the starting areas, and then we know what areas that will open, so that'll be like the second wave of creatures, and they'll be a little bit more difficult, and then from mm-hmm. those, we'll know what abilities you can gain from those, and that'll open up more of the world, and so it's kind of this tiered approach, where mm-hmm. The few areas that you can reach at the beginning will be easier, and then it'll kind of go up from there. And definitely, like going back to the idea where when I create one of these little landmark areas, coming back to it later and having it feel different, is definitely something I want to do with the combat as well. And so, you know, every once in a while, I'll throw in intentionally like a much more difficult enemy into an area. And the first time that you encounter that enemy, you're not supposed to kill him. Mm-hmm. If you want to kill everything, like you're going to have to leave and get more powerful and come back later and be like, aha, now I can take on this enemy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that sort of thing in terms of difficulty.
Mm-hmm. And that's always tricky to properly display to the player that they have to return and do something else. Like with like a mechanic based progression, as we said with Metroidvania, it's pretty simple to convey that. If the jump is too high for you to reach, then it's pretty obvious that you can't do that yet. But when you have like enemies or situations, it's kind of difficult to say to a player, oh, you can't fight this now, without just flat out putting on the screen, don't fight this guy, come back, you know, at level 5 or whatever.
So, yeah, there's definitely a couple things I have to say about that. So, when I first started creating this game, I created it as a roguelike. So, basically, you start the game, and when you die, you're dead, and the world's gone. And I thought that that kind of went against the focus of exploration in the game, because, you know, when death is final and the world is gone, it leads you to not take chances and not go down that dark corridor because you might die, and then it you have nothing more to explore because the world is gone and deleted. And so I've since changed it, and so now the autosave system is actually very lenient. And so in approaching that problem of if there's a really difficult enemy, you know, how do you get the player to like move on and not fight him? Well, currently, basically, you're going to go in, and if you're the type of person that just kills everything you encounter, you're going to try and fight him and you're going to die, and then it's going to reload you like just before that, and then you're going to go in and try and kill him and you're going to die, and you're going to do that a couple times, and you're going to be like, okay, this is impossible, and then you're going to move on. And since the autosave system is so lenient, like the iteration time on that is really short, and so I don't think that that will really frustrate players very much. But on top of that, one of the things that I want to do is when you start fighting an enemy, like their health bar pops up in the corner of the screen, and if they're like significantly stronger than you, then I'll put like a little skull and crossbones next to their name, something like that. Kind of like if you played Borderlands, what they do with their level system. If the creature that you're fighting is like higher than 5 levels above you, then it's just like a skull. Yeah, so I'll probably do something like that. But yeah, so that's definitely one thing that I've done with the game is I've had this iteration from dying be very quick. And so I think that that encourages people to explore and try new things because the consequence is death. And so if it's just a really quick load to get you back from that, then people will experiment.
Yeah. And that is very tricky in terms of whenever we have as roguelikes, as you said earlier, Jeremiah, Venture Forth is a roguelite. And one of the challenges with like a death system is if with a lot of roguelike style games, death is a very punishing thing. You die and everything is wiped, as you said. You lose all items, all progress, the world's gone, etc. And that makes it very hard to teach a player something. I've seen this in a lot of roguelikes where you'll pick up an item, and if you use it correctly, it's this overpowered, super easily boosting item. But if you use it in the wrong way, it'll kill you. And if you use it the wrong way first, you're going to be conditioned not to pick up that item again because you're thinking, oh, it killed me before, so it'll obviously kill me again. And yeah, and as you're saying, like if you can make death, it's punishing enough to say that you die, but you're, it's still lenient enough to say, okay, go nuts. mm-hmm. it becomes a little bit more fairer to let the player experiment and, you know, do whatever the hell they want. They want to try and make that jump over a cliff and miss and fall to their death 10 times.
Yeah.
They can do that.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's a giant chasm in the way, and you're like, I wonder if I can just jump across this.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, I died.
mm-hmm.
Well, now you know.
Yeah.
That's an interesting dichotomy between making death so final. And yeah, I think that really enforces experimentation, which is what this game's about. So. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good example that we can once again go back to the Souls series and how death is punishing in the sense that you lose your souls, they all drop to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not it's not as punishing as you really think. Mm-hmm. A good player knows to conserve their souls, and you're never really put into a situation where you lose something irreplaceable by dying in a Souls game. So it does let them get away with, you know, crazy traps, and you walk into a room and all of a sudden, you know, a giant monster drops down from the ceiling that can, like, two-hit kill you kind of thing.
Yep. Yeah, but even in Dark Souls, death is definitely still very punishing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I've played that game a lot, and let me tell you, sometimes when you die, it's just... you want to rage quit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, again, like as you're no doubt aware with developing Venture Forth, that balance between challenging and frustrating is so hard to maintain.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah, and so like I said, I've tried to make the autosave system very lenient, which it is, but pretty much everybody who plays the game is still like, "Oh man, this game's really hard." So I think that's good, that the game is, it's kind of trying to do what Dark Souls done in terms of difficulty, which is the game is really hard, but, the iteration time on dying is not super long. So it's easy to keep throwing yourself at this really difficult problem, and finally you get it and you're like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And once you do make it past it, it basically trains you for the next challenge and so on. I made a post, again, for those of you listening to this cast, will probably be a few weeks, maybe a few months. I don't even remember exactly when I made it. But with a game like the Souls series, you're basically being conditioned to adapt to these different mechanics. So in the process, while the game definitely becomes more challenging to play, you as the player are growing along with it. So it's not like giant difficulty spikes in a Souls game. Like, you're never going to run into something that is just, you know, completely impossible that you've never seen before. It's never, like, tested you on. It's just all about that constant growth and iteration over, you know, how many hours it's going to take you to play.
Yeah, that's actually definitely a really good point. Because, like I said, I did play Dark Souls I did play it a lot. And, you know, by the time I finally finished the game, I'm like, man, you know, I'm really good at this game. Like, I've acquired a lot of skill. And so watching somebody new play, it's like, wow, I'm so much better than them, obviously.
For me, though, like, if I return to, like, a Souls game after, like, a few months or even, like, a year, I'm back at square one again. I'm like, I've lost all that skill.
True, true. But, you know, I think if you return to it, after a little bit of playing, it'll come back without too long.
Yeah.
All
right. I know we are approaching the hour, so...
Ah, yes.
I think we will move on. I definitely want to talk more about developing Venture Forth on the Early Access platform and your thoughts on that. Before we move on to that section, then, for you, Jeremiah, are there any other aspects regarding design of Venture Forth that we haven't touched on that you'd like to bring up?
You know, I think we've touched on a lot of it. Like, well, there was the part about procedural generation. I talked about the difficulty, but I didn't talk about the procedurally generating an interesting world, which was the other part.
Okay.
So going back to that, you know, in talking about a procedurally generated world, a lot of the problems that you come across are, they're not interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a random bit of noise and it's all different and it's never the same, but it still has the feeling of being the same because it's all just, oh, this is more random stuff. And mm-hmm. so the way that I've approached that in this game is I've kind of combined the two of making things handmade and making things procedurally generated. And so the handmade are these landmark areas, and the procedural generation part is, you know, randomly selecting from the library of landmark areas, putting them into the game, and then procedurally connecting them. Mm-hmm. So when I do implement the full procedural generation, basically, when you start a new game, you don't know what areas are going to be in there or where they're going to be, but you're still going to be encountering a lot of areas that have that hand touch to make mm-hmm. them interesting. Mm-hmm. So, basically, in order to create an interesting procedurally generated world, I've tried to combine the art of handmaking with the art of procedural generation. And I think that it works.
Mm-hmm. And as we said, it's just a very tricky element compared to just making a purely linear experience. When you're mm-hmm. dealing with a very set constraint, you basically have 100% creative control over, I want the player to experience X, Y, and Z. I want them to mm-hmm. do it in this way, in this order every time. Mm-hmm. But with a procedurally generated world, unless you make it very rigid, the algorithm, the player can see things in completely different orders and experience them in different ways that you wouldn't have envisioned.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's actually part of the beauty. Mm-hmm. Because if you create, if you procedurally generate a world and the player enters it and they gain these abilities and then they find some sort of creative way to get past this gate that you weren't planning them to get past, mm-hmm. I feel like it's kind of a magical thing. It's like they've taken the rules of the world and they've followed them and mm-hmm. gotten to a secret area almost. And so I think that that's cool for both the designer and the player, because it's like, as the player, you have the feeling of, oh, I got somewhere where I'm not supposed to be. And it's also kind of interesting that a lot of times when that happens, the developer did actually know you could get there, mm-hmm. but having that feeling is incredible nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And so basically when generating a procedural world like this, since it's not linear, instead of generating like a string of things, you're generating a web of things. And mm-hmm. so every time the player gets a new ability, it opens more of the web.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then as we said earlier, as more of these abilities are added in, the world itself will basically be different to that player as they mm-hmm. gain those additional abilities and the additional ways to essentially move around in that space.
Yep.
Now, one question I just thought before we move on. As you said, there's going to be combat and a wide variety of items for the player to equip. Are items in Venture 4th, are they going to be procedurally generated, or will they be essentially set for each game?
So, it'll be procedural in which items it puts in.
Okay.
It doesn't have a procedural system like Diablo, where they have the prefix and the suffix system. There will be a set number of items. And so the reason why I chose that as opposed to, having things completely random is because kind of going back to the problem of when you make things completely random, things are different, but they still feel the same. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, getting items where like all of the stats are always different, I feel like it's not as fun as being like, oh, you know, I got the weapon that boosts your agility, and so now I can run really fast. And as you acquire, so there's common items in the game, and as you acquire duplicates of the common item, mm-hmm. it upgrades the item that you have. And so it's like, oh, yes, I got this to the next level. And so it kind of creates a consistency in the items that you have. And so they become kind of tools in your toolbox where you're like, you know, I have the item that makes me run really fast. I have the item that makes me really tanky. I have the item that gives me high DPS, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
All right, go.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's better to have like a fewer number of tactical tools than a higher number of random items.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah, and I think that's also, again, going back to, as we were saying, with building these items and the world itself. Like, for instance, with the Binding of Isaac, it does something somewhat similar. The items are all set designs. They have set functionality, mm-hmm. set abilities, but how and when you get them is completely up for grabs. You never yep. know when you're going to find that uber, you know, game-breaking item, or
uh-huh.
it may come in the very first section, or you may get when all hope is lost and you're just trying to get through the last area.
Yep.
Oh,
or not at all.
Yeah, or that can happen as well, and such as many times for me in The Binding of Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. So I think that's a good way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, if you're, it also cuts down on the complexity of the game. You're trying to design an entirely procedurally generated game with an entirely mm-hmm. procedurally generated item system. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to add, I don't even want to know how much work that's going to add to it.
Yeah. I mean, I could design a system where it procedurally generates items, but I feel like it wouldn't add a yeah. whole lot to the game. Mm-hmm. Like, procedural generation of the world, I feel like that adds a lot, mm-hmm. because much of the game is centered around exploration, and so being able to create new worlds every time you play for you to explore, I think that adds a lot to the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, it also depends on what you're actually doing in the world. For instance, mm-hmm. If combat isn't, like, the super primary focus, having the game decide between generating a sword that does 5 damage versus 4 or 6 isn't going to exactly make your game different each time.
Yeah. Yeah, and kind of an interesting point that I thought about. Mm-hmm. So I've played a lot of Diablo, mm-hmm. Diablo, the whole series, mm-hmm. Which has procedurally generated items. But it's interesting because all of the items that I'm interested in those games are always the unique yes. items that always have the same abilities, because those are always the good ones. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, yeah, Diablo has this whole procedural system, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I feel like it didn't add a whole lot to the game. And the items that really made the game interesting were the unique yeah. set ones.
The ones that essentially give you either new abilities or augment mm-hmm. ones that you already had. And again, yeah. those are, as we said, there are set items. They may have mm-hmm. some variance in terms of stats, but mm-hmm. when you find one legendary and its special power, it's always going to have that same special power. And that's
exactly.
And when you start getting to those major changes that change how you build your character, how you play the game, mm-hmm. that's where that variety comes in.
Mm-hmm. I guess just one thing that's crossed my mind mm-hmm. in terms of the procedural generation of items in Diablo. I think one way where the procedural generation did definitely change the game was when they had the auction house,
mm-hmm.
because there were certain procedurally generated items that could be incredibly good, but they were incredibly rare as well. Mm-hmm. And so unless you're working with an entire population's worth of items where they have millions of players, like, you're never going to come across these items. And so linking that whole population of players together with the auction house allowed them to be able to give players the ability to find those incredibly good procedurally generated items that are extremely rare.
Yeah.
But without that huge population, I feel like it adds a lot less.
Mm-hmm. And you always run the risk, like with Diablo 3's case, that if your game is balanced only around like those super high items, then mm-hmm. they're basically creating an artificial rarity by saying, oh, if you don't get weapons of this caliber, don't even bother playing. And we saw right. that with the original 1.0 Diablo 3, just how ball-bustingly difficult it was unless you got really lucky or you spent yeah. time on the auction house.
Mm-hmm. But then, like, then if you calibrate the game for more quote-unquote normal mm-hmm. items, when you do get those incredibly godly items, then you just face roll the whole thing.
Exactly. And that's also what's been happening with the game. I mean, I've played almost every season in terms of what they've added lately to it, and it does become very repetitive, because as you're saying, when you balance the game too far in the other direction, and there's no real need to maximize your items or worry about it, then it becomes very boring. And as you're saying, and as I've certainly have attested to, once you get like your first real legendary item, it's like the whole game just goes away.
Yeah, it's definitely a really interesting problem, balancing difficulty and items from that sense.
Yes. All right. I think with that, let's move on and talk a little bit more about the early access period of Venture Forth. And I'm sure that will probably take us to the end of the cast. And again, I mean, we could easily spend probably another 3-4 hours talking, I feel.
Yeah.
So, as we've said, you've been working on this game for a few years now. For the people listening to the cast, when are you hoping that Venture Forth will hit, I guess, one quote-unquote 1.0 and come out of early access?
So we are looking to release sometime in October. Okay. So very soon.
And when did the game actually go on early access for the people listening?
Oh gosh, what was the date? It was fairly recently. I think it was sometime in July.
All right. Now, I guess here's my first question then for you, Jeremiah. It's one that I'm sure a lot of indie developers are always wondering about. How did you decide, or how or when did you decide that Venture Forth was ready to go on early access? Because that in of itself can be its own special quagmire to figure out.
Very true. And, you know, honestly, I'm not entirely sure that I'm the best person to ask about that. Because, I mean, throughout pretty much its entire development process, the game has been in a playable state. You know, there is a program that you can load up and you can play the game.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's like, when do you finally call it and be like, okay, now it has enough stuff for players to play?
Of course.
So essentially, I think the main reason we went into early access is because the game is really close to being complete now. And we would like to start building a community around the game so that when it comes time to release, you know, there's people with that have made YouTube Let's Plays and people who've left reviews and people who are engaged in the game. And it's like, you know, it's on a lot of wish lists, that sort of thing. So that when it does come time to release, people already know about it. And also building that community around it makes it easier to playtest the game and polish it and get player feedback, that sort of thing. So basically we're in a phase where we're building the community both to get the word out there as well as polish up in this last phase before we release.
As we've talked, as you said, Jeremiah, it's very tricky to know that because as a designer, it's very easy to say that I'm enjoying this game. I can, you know, let's put it up there right now, you know, alpha 0.001. But as I've talked to a lot of developers about, especially over the course of 2016, there is no quote-unquote standard for what's considered early access. We've seen games go up there, again, that could be, again, version 0.001. And then there are games that are literally like 90% done. And again, they just need like those last little, you know, smoothing things out kind of deal.
Yeah. I'm definitely more of a perfectionist and I suffer from what I call chronic it's not done yet syndrome. And so, like, I'm definitely very hesitant to show people the game because, you know, there's things that I'm like, yeah, I know that's not perfect. I know that's not done yet. But I think that it's important to start getting it out there before it's completely done. Because, you know, if you just work in a vacuum the entire time and then you release, it's like, well, nobody knows what you're talking about. And you haven't gotten feedback. And it's so it is, you do need to get it out there.
Yep. And it's only one of those very tricky situations to deal with, as you're no doubt aware of, and any developers listening, people will expect certain things of your game on early access, and they will find any issue with it. If there's a bug or there's a problem, someone somewhere will figure it out way before you will.
Yeah.
I guess my next question for you, Jeremiah, in terms of Venture Forth and going on early access itself, as you said, the game was already close to being finished before. You said it's only been on for like 2 or 3 months at this time. I guess, have you gotten like any really useful feedback, or has the fan base really helped influence the development of the game since it's been on early access?
Well, honestly, we haven't been putting a whole lot of effort into like marketing and getting the word out yet. So, I mean, we still haven't really grown the community very large yet. So we haven't really gotten a whole lot of good feedback yet. We have recently started getting a couple of people on, but it's a process that we're still in the middle of. So. Yeah. It's a lot of work.
Definitely.
In general, and it's difficult to keep up on everything. Always. Story of a game developer's
life. Yes, it is. Yeah. And with the game being on early access, I guess here's a question that I'd like to ask all the developers who I have on who have either gone through it or doing it at the moment. For you as a designer putting this game together and going through the early access, what do you think of the actual early access program, being able to sell your game and use this as a way of testing and gauging the waters, in a manner of speaking?
I think that it's a valuable option, but it's a tool that is that can be difficult to use correctly. So I would label it as early access is a tool, and you need to know how to use it correctly, and that can be very difficult. Yes. So,
and I think that's a really good point there. I've spoken to developers in the past, and I think the one thing everyone agrees on is you have to have the right game for early access to work. Like, as we've said, a linear 8 to 10 hour dungeon crawler RPG is probably not going to be the best game for early access. But if you have a game that's going to require a lot of testing, or something that's going to be very ambitious and big, you know, something like RimWorld, Dwarf Fortress, Terraria, and Starbound. Those games fit better because you can actually see, you can track their growth, and the fan base can just do wonders for giving you ideas or finding issues you would never even consider.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, there are some games that have been developed with Unity throughout the entire process, from conception until final release. And I think that in general, that is actually a really good way to make a game, but it can be really difficult to get it started. So, you know, somewhere like every week you release a build and then the people who are interested in your game try it out and give you feedback. And, you know, this happens for like 100 weeks.
Yeah.
And so if you're able to do that, that will, I feel like success is almost guaranteed because you have so much feedback from the actual community that's going to be purchasing your game. The difficulty is getting those people to start trying your game out in the first place. So,
And that is a really good point there, Jeremiah. And one I think every developer who may be listening to this cast has dealt with at some point with their game. And it also leads into the greater issue of, or the challenge of, marketing your game as well. And unfortunately, we don't have enough time tonight to get too far into that. But it's definitely a serious issue. And for developers to go the early access route, it becomes all the more so. If you're trying to use early access to figure out how your game is going to do or find any issues, if no one's playing your game, then there's just nothing there.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to marketing, I feel like there's two main parts of it. One is like the quality of your game and how much people actually like it. And the other part is your marketing and how many people know about it. And so if all of those, if either of those are not good, nobody's going to buy your game.
Yeah.
Because if everybody knows about it, but everybody knows that it's crappy, nobody's going to buy it. But if it's really good, but nobody knows about it, also nobody's going to buy it.
Of course. And it's always, a very tricky cycle, or very frustrating cycle, I should say, to get
around. Very difficult to get both of those.
Now, one thing that I definitely wanted to touch on with Venture Forth with you, Jeremiah, is I was checking out the Early Access page, and I saw that you were also going the route similar to Prison Architect, with pricing it higher during the Early Access period, and then rolling the price down when the game hits 1.0. And obviously, I know the answer from reading the page, but for developers listening, and even consumers and enthusiasts listening, what was the reasoning behind having the price higher now?
So the main reason is to limit the number of people who are part of this early access community. So basically, having the price higher makes sure that only the people that are really interested in this type of game will be the ones giving you feedback and that sort of thing, rather than, you know, if it was just free, anybody could come along, download it, try it out for 2 minutes and be like, didn't like it, sucks. And like, that's not really helpful. So having a higher price point limits your player base to the really dedicated players who will most likely give you a lot better feedback.
And as we said a few seconds ago, it definitely worked with Prison Architect for a time. But we can also see how it can bite the developer in a case like Planetary Annihilation, who priced their original, very first version of Planetary Annihilation, the Alpha, for like $80 on Early Access. And again, it's all about that balance of getting maximizing your value, but at the same time, not, you know, pissing off your fan base.
I mean, which is part of the reason why on our page we're so upfront about, hey, guys, the price is higher right now. It's going to be lower. So, like, fair warning. If you really don't want to pay a little bit of extra money, like, don't get it now.
And
so, yeah, we're trying to be very upfront and fair with everyone. And so that's definitely important.
And that level of transparency, as we've seen, is just a very big deal, especially with the rise of so many forms of crowdfunding and trying to keep the consumer's trust. And if you don't do that, it can definitely come back to bite any developer with their project.
Yeah, it definitely can. And I think that that level of that kind of transparency is just a really good thing in general, because, you know, it makes your community like you more, and your community is what's going to be making you successful. So, you know, make friends with them. Be kind. Be good people. In the end, I mean, we're all just people.
I think I am just about out of questions. So, before we, I guess, get into like my final set of questions for you, Jeremiah, are there any other aspects behind the early access and developing the game that we haven't touched on yet that you would like to bring up?
I think we've gone over most of the interesting stuff. I think so.
All right. In that case, to wrap up the cast, I have a few, I guess, looking forward questions for you, and then we will say goodnight. So, I guess the first one then, obviously, as we said, Venture Forth right now is currently in early access at the time of this recording. And just to reiterate for the folks listening, you are planning on going to 1.0, hopefully in October. Now, as we were saying earlier, 1.0 doesn't mean you're going to stop working on the game. So, I guess, what, besides the adding more procedural elements to Venture Forth, what are some other ideas you have, or if you're currently thinking of, that you're planning on continuing to support the game with past 1.0?
So, basically, after release, there are two major things that I still want to add. One of them is full world procedural generation, like we talked about. And the other is alternate dimensions. Which, basically, what it is all of the space in the world exists in multiple, shall we call, places. So you might be going through an area called the Abyss, but there's like an alternate version of the Abyss that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's got a little bit of different items, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you will acquire the ability to swap between these different planes of dimensions. Mm. And so this can act as, I mean, it all hinges back to exploration. And so there'll be different things to find in each of these spaces. And it can also work as a gating mechanic where, like, only certain passageways to new areas exist in one of the dimensions. Mm-hmm. And so going back in an alternate dimension may open up a new thing.
Cool. Definitely sounds very ambitious. I think on top of the full procedural generation that you have planned.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've from a technical aspect, like I said, from the very beginning, I've entered this whole project from like the programming point of view. So from a technical aspect, like I know exactly how I want to do it, and it's very doable. So, and same thing with procedural generation. Mm-hmm. It takes work and time.
Definitely. Of course.
Yeah.
All right. I think that just about does in terms of my questions for you. So, I guess my final question for you, Jeremiah, for tonight then is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening to the cast right now?
You can find it on Early Access. If it sounds interesting, go check it out.
Awesome. Okay. Again, Jeremiah, it's been a pleasure talking with you tonight. We've touched on a lot of interesting topics, and again, each one of these topics can easily be their own cast in of itself. Mm-hmm. And I've said this so many times on these casts. It's so easy to get off track when we're talking design.
Yep.
But yeah, I definitely wish you the best of luck with Venture Forth. And
thank you.
Hopefully we can have you back on in the future, either to talk more about the game or even like touch on any one of the number of topics we've slightly talked about tonight.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of interesting stuff that we can go further into.
Awesome. All right. So with all that said, we're going to wrap it up here for this week's cast. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. To write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. We are always looking for new guests and people to talk to, so please don't be afraid to send me an email. Be sure to subscribe on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates of new content, as well as thoughts from me throughout the day. And of course, check out the Patreon campaign. You can find me on there under Game Wisdom. Your donations can give us the much-needed monthly funding we need to keep going and growing. You can get some decent and nifty little rewards we have up there. And if we can hit some goals, it will mean more content for everyone to enjoy. And last but not least, check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. You can find me on there under Game Wisdom, as well as a link on the front page for a collection and wide variety of Let's Breaks, indie spotlights, game reviews, and my own game design vlog series. So, with all that said, once again, Jeremiah, thank you so much for coming on tonight. It was definitely a fun, almost an hour and a half of talking to you tonight.
Yeah, it's definitely been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So once again, thank you for tuning in to this week's cast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will see you all next time. Take care.